From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Conch Street.
I'm Ekta. I'm from Walnut Creek and also from Thailand.
El Cerrito.
From Oakland.
From Albany, California.
Coming up, the first look inside the Navigation Center, a new program that wants to house San Francisco's homeless.
And then all of a sudden I hear her, baby, baby. She's screaming, right? And I stuck my head off the tent and she said, pack your stuff, they're coming to get us. And I was like, what?
Then we'll hear about a new approach to a very old play.
We took great liberties. We deconstructed it. There are a lot of purists who will probably be very unhappy with what we did, which is great.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
The thing that I'm talking about, that fire in us, that's what binds us as a club.
Doing things a little differently today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Not long ago, the lot at 1950 Mission Street in San Francisco was dead space, a closed-down school site with a few portable structures that had been vacant for more than a decade. On March 30th, the gates opened on a new pilot program called the Navigation Center. It's a pop-up homeless shelter testing a hunch that people are more likely to make it off the street if they're allowed to stay with their possessions, partners, and pets. Expectations are high. City officials say once it's fully up and running, the Navigation Center will be able to get people from homeless to housed in just 10 days. And the experiment's already been heralded as one of the country's most innovative. KLW's Liz Pfeffer has been hanging around since day one and brings us this report.
March 29th, 2015 was the last night Delilah Soto slept on the street. She's a recovering heroin addict who's been living in a tent in San Francisco's Mission District with her girlfriend Rocky Anderson and their dog Sparta. That night, she learned they had another choice. They camped behind the Mission Best Buy with their friends, waiting for the homeless outreach team to take them to the Navigation Center. Soto's girlfriend heard them first.
And then all of a sudden I hear her, baby, baby, she's screaming, right? And I'm thinking, oh, she must have found a rock or something because she likes rocks. And I stuck my head out the tent and she said, pack your stuff, they're coming to get us.
Now they live in a dorm room in one of the Navigation Center's portable trailers. There are bathrooms and places to hang out, all surrounded by a metal fence. Even inside, you can hear the traffic from Mission Street. But the walls make a big difference.
First day, it was kind of like surreal for me. Like, you know all the pretty pictures they have? I didn't even notice them until the second day. And I was like, wow, was I in that much? Because I was just like, oh my God. Because we've been out there since last July. It is so hard. You know, you have to find a place to squat, and make sure nobody's looking, or if you find a restaurant or somewhere where they have a bathroom, you go in, they look at you all crazy, and it's very, very hard. You know, and I peed my pants too several times just because I couldn't find somewhere, you know, and it's crazy. It's crazy. It's hard.
If all goes according to plan, Soto won't have to go back to that life. The Navigation Center is a temporary pilot program that the city's running in collaboration with the nonprofit Interfaith Council. They got $3 million from an anonymous donor to get people like Soto into permanent homes within just a few weeks, all without severing the connections they made on the street. Each person's experience is being translated into data that the San Francisco Comptroller's Office tracks in real time. And time is short. The city's already planned a separate affordable housing development here, and the center will have to shut down when construction starts. There's also an election coming up in November, and a mayor eager to address what many city residents say is their biggest annoyance and concern. Right now, though, Soto isn't worried about any of that. She's busy watching Sparta play with another dog, Rodney O'Neill's pit bull, Bubby.
So they're actually best friends. They wake up together, so they're all hyped about it. So now they're just, like, really happy they wake up together. They can't believe it.
They're in each other's space all
the time. 24/7.
There was just a sense of relief that people had, and you could just see them looking around going, wow, you know, my things are here, my partner's here, my dog is here, and yet and still I can access a range of services.
Bevan Dufty is spearheading the project. He's with the Mayor's Office of Housing Opportunity, Partnerships, and Engagement. The services he's talking about include case management and direct access to benefits. there are at least 4 agencies on site.
Getting on general assistance here in San Francisco can take 6 weeks and 4 appointments, and so we're going to be able to accomplish that in 1 week. So that's pretty dramatic.
The center can accommodate 75 people. Right now, there are about 30, half with dogs. The idea of getting all of them from streets to stable housing in 10 days or less might not be feasible. People staying at the center say they're hearing 15 to 30 days is more likely. Julie Ledbetter, the center's director, says whether it takes 1 week or 3, drastically changing your life in that short a time is a success.
Then it actually gives us time to sort of stay with people, let them sort of get cleaned up, take a shower, relax. You know, over the course of 3 days or so, you see people really changing their frame of mind and being able to be ready to take on these bigger challenges.
This is what's happening to Delilah Soto. By the 9th day of her stay, she says it feels like a huge weight has been lifted off her shoulders. Her girlfriend told her,
"You look so relaxed." She said, you're starting to look like the woman that I fell in love with back then, you know, because I was stressed all the time. It was just constant. I was constantly stressed.
Now a home is just a piece of paperwork away.
I have to go online and find out how much we need a copy of our domestic partnership paper. And that's it. I mean, she's doing it anyway. You know what I mean? She's already working on it, which is cool. But that's the last thing we have to hand in.
But there are plenty of people whose exits from the center aren't in clear sight. There's a man with advanced stomach cancer, an elderly woman who's been sleeping on the sidewalk of 16th Street. And then there are people like Edward Speller.
When I was evicted, finally had to actually leave the apartment, physically leave the apartment building. I ended up sleeping in a doorway that was 3 doors down from the building that I lived in.
Speller just turned 52, but he looks older. Homelessness wears on people, causing them to age more quickly than others. And Speller says he's been homeless since 2013, when he lost his apartment because he couldn't afford to pay rent.
I can't even describe it. Yeah, I can't even describe it.
But since he's been homeless, he's found a community.
My main forte really is women's clothes. That's what I started out with.
Even though he has a bed at the Navigation Center, Speller returns to 8th and Market Streets every night to open his shop, a blanket on the ground displaying random items that he sells. The center's meeting his physical needs, but he's not sure it can meet his emotional ones.
Yeah, we try and consider ourselves, those of us who know each other and are in this situation, family. You know, we are really pretty much all we have to rely on when it comes to someone looking out for us or having our best interest at heart. There are places like, you know, we can go and eat at and places where, you know, shelters that you can go sleep at. But when it comes to someone really having a heartfelt concern for you, there's no place to go for that.
I love this.
Yeah.
Delilah Soto's friend Rodney O'Neill was the first person in the center.
And I'm trying to organize a little movie, Friday night movie thing where we can put a screen up somewhere and watch movies because the little community, it helps. Yeah. You know, it makes everybody kind of feel, you know, like, you know, a little more homey and everything, what have you.
He's not going to be the first one out. Someone else was already asked to leave for not following the program. But it looks like he's going to be the first one to make it into a home.
My housing came through today. Yeah, yeah. I went to my interview today, and they did a background check and everything. So they're just waiting for everything to just kind of get settled and all the paperwork and the T's and the I's and everything. And then, you know, they said by the 22nd I should be in.
O'Neill is one success. If the city wants to meet its goals for housing the Mission District's homeless, there are still hundreds to go. 2.5 weeks in, the idea of bringing entire encampments into transitional housing together has worked, anecdotally. But when the experiment ends, the numbers will be the story. For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Pfeffer.
Currents. I'm Hannah Baba.
We just heard about a new approach to solving homelessness in the Mission District. If you headed over a few blocks to the Marsh Theater on Valencia Street, you'd find a man named Jeff Hoyle trying a new approach to one of the most classic plays, King Lear by William Shakespeare. It's the story of a king who decides to divide his kingdom amongst his three daughters by testing their loyalty and ends up making some bad decisions. In Lear's Shadow, we hear the jester's side of the story, who in the original play is a seemingly frivolous character who actually has deeper insight into life than most of his peers. David LaTulipe is host of the KALW program Open Air. He sat down with Jeff Hoyle, who takes the lead role of the jester and helped write Lear's Shadow, to learn about why he decided to play the fool.
Tell me about your relationship in general with Shakespeare.
I've had a relationship as an English schoolboy with Shakespeare since I was probably about 11. But King Lear was my set book for my A-level.
What is that?
Examinations.
A-level.
A-levels, they're somewhat similar to the SATs, except you have to write a series of essays during the time. And so we had to study Lear, and we couldn't take the text in with us. So any quotes we had to commit to memory. So there's a lot of it that I've already known for about 50, 60 years.
Stuck
almost.
In those brainwaves, yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt.
My relationship with Shakespeare goes way back, and I've never done the fool in Lear. In fact, I've not really played any Shakespeare clowns other than Stefano in The Tempest, who is not really a clown, but he's a character clown.
I was going to say, are you a follower of Shakespeare's fools in general? Character study?
They're really obscure. This is the problem. They don't speak to us in the same way.
Oh, especially Yorick.
Yorick, yeah. Well,
not speaking much at all.
Sure, yeah. Then there's the fool in Lear, who isn't really that funny and speaks in this medieval, tautological, strange, riddle-strewn language.
And is far from a fool when it comes down to it. He's really giving the king...
Yeah. So, I've always loved King Lear and I've always wanted to play it. And no one will ever cast me as King Lear because I'm 130 pounds and I'm, 5'6".
So in productions of Lear that you've seen, we were always more interested in maybe watching the acting skills and role interpretation of the fool than Lear?
Was I always interested? I'm probably more interested in Lear in a sense. And the fool is his prop and his cufflink and his first thing handy at the side of the stage to hit. And then the fool disappears in the middle of the show, because Edgar comes along and obviously Shakespeare thinks, well, I don't need two fools or two bottom-of-the-barrel scrapers, so we'll get rid of the fool. So he just disappears, literally just goes. So what we thought was, well, maybe the fool is there, even though he doesn't have any words. And then as a friend of mine who's a writer, I was in Paris, and we were sitting in a cafe, and I was telling him about this idea for doing something on Lear because I wanted to do some of Lear. And he said, well, and everybody says, oh, yeah, Jeff Hoyle might cast him as the fool. Thanks a lot. And he said, well, why don't you tell the story of Lear from the point of view of the fool? And so that's what David Ford and I set out to do. And we took great liberties. We deconstructed it. There are a lot of purists who would probably be very unhappy with what we did, which is great because, that's what we
do. Pushes the envelope. So was I right in the introduction in that this is post-mortem rex and then this is after the king dies and he's now...
Post-mortem rex. Yes, after the death of the king's dog, Rex. I don't want to say too much because I think people will be surprised at how we do it a little bit. But yes, the fool comes back after the play is over. And after the events of the play are over, and then he is, in a certain way, shunted into the position of having to tell the story of it. And he does. And I, as an actor, play the fool and Lear and the three daughters. Regan, Goneril, and Cordelia.
Okay. Well, I was rereading some of the Fool's lines last night. Rather
don't,
late.
Don't. No, no, you'll kill yourself. Yes.
And as I mentioned, he's anything but a fool, really reversing roles with his benefactor, quite critical and spot on of the king's foibles and decisions, and bad decisions. Now, unemployed as others in the king's circles would not tolerate a fool as lightly as...
Well, he's unemployed because the king's dead. Basically, you know.
And others around him have witnessed his foul tongue or his rather frank tongue. I wouldn't hire him.
Well, yeah, but he was able to speak truth to power, and he was the best of his kind at it. So he was very well respected because he had the protection of the king. So yes, there are people who are probably happy that he's fallen, but he needs to work. So here he is, post-mortem Rex, you know, he's looking for work.
And so when you go back and forth with the other characters, does the fool chime in? Is it a back-and-forth thing, or is it a character that appears for a while?
No, he comments. So, and specifically, we've tried to use the text, the Shakespeare, as a basis for some fairly off-the-cuff comments that the fool makes about power, about the king, about the other characters, and also about his own condition. That, you know, he starts to realize as he's recounting what he's actually been through the last 47 years as he's been the king, because we make him a king contemporary of the king. So he's as old as the king. And, you know, as the king says, even though we don't use the line, I'm very foolish, fond old man, fourscore and up. So he's over 80. Well, I'm not playing him over 80. But I've had some practice. You know, I did Geezer. It seems a logical progression to do a piece about
loose hair and
about losing your shtick, you know, as you get older.
That was actor and director Jeff Hoyle, who spoke with David LaTulippe on KALW's program Open Air last week. Learn more about Lear's shadow at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area sonic signature. Here's the curator of the sounds, Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this very alarming sound.
You know, one day we decided to have a party where every rat fought another rat. I really thought it was going to be a one-time party, but then everybody's like, when's the next one?
He's done? All right, he's done. He's done.
Do you know what that was and where we recorded it? I know someone who does. KALW's Liza Veal brings us the story.
A back lot in West Oakland is packed in tight with punk rock bikers. It's an infestation of black leather. They're even on the neighboring roofs, all crowded in around a boxing ring. Two guys, one barefoot with long dreads, the other stocky with a buzz cut, go at each other. One backs the other against the ropes and pummels his face with boxing gloves. At one corner of the ring, an enormously tall man with the words East Bay Rats written across the back of his leather jacket douses one of the fighters in water and coaches him in a soothing voice.
You're catching him with a jab and you're nailing him, but he's also catching you with the jab.
My name's Trevor Latham. I'm the president of the East Bay Rats.
The East Bay Rats Motorcycle Club, a group of guys who pay membership dues to ride together, work on bikes, and throw parties. We're in the back lot of their Oakland clubhouse. And this is fight night. Anyone can get in the ring. They follow boxing regulations, so it's technically legal. But in truth, it gets dirtier than pro boxing. There's grappling, hits to the back of the head. The fighting started...
way before that stupid movie.
Way before that stupid movie. Fight Club, you know, with Brad Pitt.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
In the movie, they don't use gloves. Here, they do. And you may think that sanitizes the fight, but Latham says it's the opposite. In a bare-knuckle fight, your fists tend to give out before anyone actually gets knocked out. The gloves mean the hits are harder and go on longer. The fighter in our corner, the one with the buzz cut, pants between rounds. He's drenched in sweat. I ask him,
what hurts?
Nothing.
And how he's feeling.
Pure adrenaline.
Pure adrenaline. Trevor Latham says that's what the East Bay Rats are all about.
Motorcycles are dangerous, and they're the thing I love the most and the thing that I hate the most, you know. But I think that if I didn't have motorcycles, I would risk my life in another way to get the same amount of excitement. Some sort of demon chasing me, you know. And that, the thing that I'm talking about, that's what binds us as a club.
The club started in 1994.
We were just a group of friends riding bikes. We didn't exactly fit in with other bike clubs. We did things a little different. We had our own style. We had our own way. We were into like Mad Max style bikes. That's like rat bikes. Flat black, ugly, duct tape, held together with baling wire. We'd put all our money into just making it go faster and crashing it, and then zero money into chrome and paint.
Is a motorcycle club closer to a book club or a gang?
You know, if we were in Berkeley, we would be in jail. But in Oakland, we're freaking saints.
So it's just they have bigger fish.
Yeah.
Latham says some East Bay rats may be doing some dirt, but the club isn't organized around a single money-making crime, which is his definition of a gang.
None of us make a dollar off of this. I also don't think for us, if any of us profit off of it, would work.
I really should have asked if the bike club was closer to a book club, a gang, or a church.
We do a really good job of reining ourselves in and being a family for each other and understanding each other. And yeah, when people start going off the deep end, I can sheepdog them back a little bit.
Sheepdog them back, meaning they keep club members from going astray. Latham says that for a rat, burning off aggression in the ring is exactly the kind of salvation that might keep the rest of his life intact. This fight turned out to be one of the longest in Rat's history, 9 rounds. It didn't end in a knockout. It ended when one guy began to dry heave and gave up the fight. Once he'd pulled himself together, he and his opponent shook hands. Then they hugged. Then they sort of locked together, holding each other by the back of the head, smiling, deliriously, insanely, on an adrenaline trip that would suspend them above pain. At least for about 10 more minutes, Latham told me. Then they'd start to feel again.
We don't have judges.
For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This week, we've got something special for you. Our winner is here with us in the studio. Now, that's because when I called him this morning to tell him he won, he told me he was in town visiting from L.A. He couldn't believe he got the sound right, and he was so excited he wanted to come see us in person. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Okay, my name's Sean Bonfield. I'm a fireman in Los Angeles County, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So you knew exactly what this was. Can you tell me, how did you know?
The East Bay Rats Motorcycle Club was doing a charitable event, if I recall. And although I didn't witness any of the boxing or any of the matches or anything like that, my buddy told me this is what they do. They have like a fight night or, you know, rat versus rat fighting each other. And the next thing I know is like, okay, I put two and two together and I figured it out. And it was just like, I think I got this one. So I was just like, okay, I'm calling in. By the way, I never call in. I don't do that.
Well, we are so glad you actually came and paid us a visit. And instead of sending you a t-shirt, we're just going to give you one because you're right here.
That's awesome. And I'll wear it with pride. And I'll tell you what, I'm very honored to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. That was our winner today, Sean Bonfield, in person in the studio. And our favorite thing about Audiograph is getting to know our listeners. So Do you have ideas for where we should record next? Give us a call, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I can't wait to hear from you. Thanks for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
We really like it when you call, but you can also email us at news@kalw.org or catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Chris Hoff, Hannah Kingsley-Ma, Casey Miner, Seth Samuel, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Ted Muldoon. The line producer was Nina Gensler-Debs. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco band Vinyl Spectrum. They play live tomorrow night at Bottom of the Hill in the city. They're the opening band, starting at about 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. She looks up at-